Okay, this is Akela with Miss Waniki on August the 11th, 2015. Thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this project. It will surely benefit the community now and in the future. The goal of this questionnaire is to produce as detailed and coherent a narrative of your story as possible. In light of that, I encourage you to feel free not to worry about providing an answer that is too long or too in-depth. Do you have any questions?
Nope.
In what year were you born?
1948.
Okay. Where were you born?
Oakland, California.
How would you describe yourself in terms of racial and ethnic identity?
African American.
What is the last level of schooling you completed?
I went to a private nursing school. So it was a 3-year program, so if you add that to 12 years of secondary school, it's 15 years. At that time, most of the nurses were being trained at hospital-based schools, so that was before the baccalaureate programs, but at my school, we did receive a diploma and an AA degree.
Are you married or have you been married?
Yes, I've been married twice and I'm divorced.
Tell me about your place of birth and what was going on there then and as you were growing up.
Okay, I was born in Oakland, California, post-World War II. Back in the 1930s, there was a large migration of African Americans from Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, coming to work in the shipyards around Oakland, San Francisco, Vallejo. And basically there were jobs. People were leaving the farms from picking cotton and moving to California. So my mother moved to Oakland in 1944. My dad was still fighting the war in Germany. And my grandparents also moved, so when my father got out of the service, he did not return to Arkansas. He went right to California where he got a job with the Naval Air, which was part of the government. But in that particular area of California, we had, you know, the Navy, the Presidio in San Francisco, which was the Army, Treasure Island, Richmond Shipyard, Vallejo Shipyard, Oakland Shipyard. So there were jobs. Unfortunately, racism was still alive and thriving, and black people were relegated to living in a certain area, which was West Oakland. So it was pretty crowded. It wasn't until mid-50s that black people started to branch out and move to other areas of Oakland. But of course, with that came the white flight. As we moved out, they moved further.
What were your dreams for the future?
As a little girl, I used to sit on the porch and look at the clouds and say that I know if I hadn't come to this country, I would have been a princess in Africa. So I guess I sort of fell in love with teaching. I loved my 5th and 6th grade teacher, Mrs. Bass. I think of her often. And up until the time that I graduated, 3 months before I graduated from high school, I was going to be a teacher. And then I applied for a nursing scholarship and won the scholarship, so I went to nursing school. But I had dreams of being a teacher. My mom died when I was 13 in the 8th grade, so we had to give up our home. I had a brother, 10, and a sister, 11. And my dad worked for General Motors at the time, building cars, and we had to move to an apartment, so our life sort of changed that way. You know, my father worked on assembly line, so, you know, he'd only gone to the 8th grade, so back in those days, two parents graduated from high school was a big deal. But I just remember my mother always telling me, she was domestic, she did not want me to have to clean anybody's toilet to get an education so I could stand on my own 2 feet and take care of myself. And so I just kept that tape going on in my head, and I pushed really hard so that I could go to college. So I was the first one in my family to go to college and to graduate. So I was a professional nurse at age 21. But I had to grow up really fast. You know, I was 13, so my dad was old school. I was the oldest, so he brought his check home and said, okay, you got to pay this bill, you got to buy this food, you got to do the laundry. And my mother, I think she had cancer that she knew she was going to die that last year, so she was pushing me really hard to learn all these things. So I had to grow up really fast to take care of my brother and sister. My dad did not remarry. And he was an incredible father. Never brought a woman home. He went to church 3 times a year, but he made sure we went every Sunday because that's what my mother would have wanted. He rode the bus halfway across Oakland. But he was a good dad, really good dad, exceptional.
So some of these questions are going to be repetitive, but I'm going to say them anyway just in case there's anything you want to add.
Okay.
What were your family's dreams for your future?
Because my mother, my parents worked on, you know, they grew up on farms. And so during that time of Jim Crow and segregation, they could only go to school part of the time because they had to pick the crops. Like, I think most of the children, the white children, started school in August. They couldn't start until October because they had to pick the crops. And then in March, they were out because then it was planting time. So both of them probably went to around the 8th grade. So my mother was really, really into education. You know, she used to sit and help us with our homework. I don't think she understood half of it, but she was sitting, pushing us every night to excel, to get a college education, because this is going to be avenue to a better life for us, and ability to get a job and not have to depend on anyone and not have to do menial type of work. So she had dreams of us becoming nurses, teachers, lawyers, and she'd get so excited. Oh, I just love to bring A's home on my report card because I swear she did a somersault. And I get this is so disappointed after she died, and I show my father my report card, and he just turned it over, and I said, but I got 6 A's. He said, oh, okay. Because, you know, he was a single man raising 3 children, trying to put food on the table, and, you know, at that time, factory workers were making $80 a week, so his focus was on providing shelter and food for us, and, you know, the education wasn't the priority. It was just graduate from high school and get a job at the bank. But I didn't want to do that. You know, a lot of the kids that I went to school with, that's what they did. They graduated from high school. College was expensive, and they couldn't go. I was blessed to apply for the scholarship and actually beat the girl out that had better grades. She had 4.0. I think I had a 3.6. But it was a private club in Montclair, which is a town close by, called the Lorraine de Nicolai Club, and they saw that it was a single parent home and that there was more need. So I got the scholarship over this young lady, which shocked the heck out of her, and it was $2,600, but in 1966, $2,600 was like $50,000 because that was earnings. You know, people made $3,000 in 1 year back then. Yeah, I graduated from nursing school. Our salary was $500 a month, and I thought I was rich. I mean, gas was 25 cents a gallon. A loaf of bread was a dime. I mean, I bought my first car. It was $1,800. So, you know, it's all relative.
Was it $800 or $1,800?
$1,800 was a brand new car. And gas, I would fill up my tank for $2.90. So it's all relative. But I remember when I got my first check, because we got paid once a month, I went to the grocery store and I bought like $200 worth of food, steaks and shrimp and crab, all the stuff that I didn't eat when I was in nursing school. But I mean, my rent, I had a 2-bedroom house, the rent was $70, so it's all relative.
Wow. What were your childhood and teenage years like?
I had a wonderful childhood growing up with two loving parents who had fallen in love with each other when they were in, I guess, secondary school, 7th, 8th grade. But because my mother was very, very dark-skinned, and my father was very, very light-skinned with blue eyes, and unfortunately, my grandparents had the color hang-up, and they discouraged my father and mother from seeing each other. So they went their separate ways. She married someone else, divorced him, moved to California, and they met up again after they came to California. And of course, I'm told she had a boyfriend, but she ditched the boyfriend and hooked up again with my dad, and they were married, and my grandmother wasn't happy because, again, he was marrying a dark-skinned woman. But he was 34, she was 31, so they were adults. You know, they weren't a bunch of kids or young kids having a family. They wanted children, and we were doted on. We lived in the projects initially until we could save money to get a house, and we got a house. My dad had a job. My mother worked as a domestic, but she'd only work like part of the day. When I walked in that door at 3:15, I could smell dinner. She had cupcakes or cookies. There was a lot of structure, when we were growing up. That you came home from school, you took your clothes off, you hung them up, you put on your play clothes, you did your chores, and you went outside to play. After dinner, you wash the dishes, you clean the stove, you dried the dishes, you put them away, you swept the kitchen, and you did your homework and got ready for bed. So there was a lot of structure in our home. We went to Sunday school, we went to church, we went to Baptist Training Union, and our lives were sort of built around the church. We didn't go to fancy restaurants, nothing like that, but we were happy. I mean, we enjoyed Christmas. We couldn't afford real expensive gifts, but I remember one Christmas, my mother was very practical. You know, she would give a 10-year-old a first piece of Samsonite luggage, and I'm saying, who wants a suitcase? And I'm looking out the window at all these kids that have skates and bikes, and she saw the disappointment on my face, so the next day she went and bought us some skates. And she did the same thing again another year. She brought me a beautiful Japanese jewelry box that you opened and had the music and stuff, because she's always thinking practically. But my brother got the army men and all the cars and the toys, and I'm thinking, what's up with this? And my sister and I had to share a doll, but she was very practical in that sense. But she was an incredible woman. Really into chores, though. Oh, washing. All the towels had to be together on the line. All the sheets, as if the neighbors were looking. You have to fold them as you're taking them down. We ironed everything. I never slept on a sheet that wasn't ironed until after my mother died. Iron sheets, pillowcases. I started learning how to iron, I think, when I was 5 years old. I stood up on a 7-Up box, and I would press our used-to-wear t-shirts, undershirts. And my cousin used to tease me all the time. She said, your mama was so clean. If you guys got dirty, she changed your clothes 3 times a day. But, yeah, I think that's why I hate making my bed now. Because it was like when you got out of the bed, you did an about face, you made the bed, you did not sit on the bed. My mother said, you sit in chairs, not on the bed. So I sit on it every chance I get, because I couldn't do it growing up. But she was my best friend when I lost her. It was pretty rough. Pretty rough there for a while. Yeah. But she was young, she was only 44. Yeah. But I had a great childhood up until that time, and then, you know, things had to change. I had to grow up real fast. I had to give up some things. I wanted to be a cheerleader so bad. Oh, I wanted to be a cheerleader. But I had to come straight home from school, you know, because I had to take care of my brother and sister, and my dad worked second tour. So he would be going to work at 3:30, and I would have to run home because he needed to see the white of my eyes before he got in the car with the guy that he commuted with. So a lot of things I couldn't do after school. Sometimes I could go to football games and, you know, stuff like that, but I had to come home and see that my brother and sister did their homework and that I fixed dinner, because at 8 o'clock he was going to call, and you better not be on the phone with anybody. See, he had to interrupt that line. You were going to be in trouble when he got home at 11:30. So, yeah.
What did you most like to do or get into when you were a child or teenager?
I love play. My father was a pitcher. You know, he played baseball in Arkansas, and that was his dream deferred because of Jim Crow. When the Negro Leagues came back in 1935, Kansas City Monarchs came through, and they wanted him to go, but my grandmother was a staunch Methodist, and she thought, not getting on the bus going from town to town with them women chasing you, she said, no. And he was 21, and I said, why didn't you go? They were making 50 cents a day picking cotton. He said, well, you did what your parents said. But so it was, he was very good. You know, his fastball was 95 miles an hour back then. And so what did he do? As soon as he got through with the war, that's the first thing he did was find a team to play ball. Well, then he's like, what, 33 years old, something like that. But he was able to get on a team in California, and even then, in 1945, he was only black on the team. So that's when he was able to barnstorm with Jackie Robinson. He had met Jackie Robinson at Fort Riley, Kansas, when they got called up. Jackie was a lieutenant because he had graduated from UCLA with a degree, so you were an officer. So they played together there. And they were trying to segregate them. My dad loved to tell that story, that he was an officer, and he said that if the blacks and whites don't play together, nobody was going to play. So they played, and they played in Germany. My uncle tells me, because he was there too. And I said, well, I thought you guys were fighting a war. How were you playing baseball? He said, we had R&R time, and John was pitching. So, okay. So when he came back in 46, Jackie got called up by the Brooklyn Dodgers. And so he had to go to the farm team, and then my dad's team, they call it barnstorming. He barnstormed with his team, and somewhere in the northern United States, I want to say Oregon, but I know they barnstormed together in Montreal. So now I've forgotten what your original question was. I just went off on that. But it was about my childhood.
Mm-hmm. What you most like to do or get into?
Oh, I love to play baseball because my dad was a pitcher. We all had to pitch. Although when I was little, I hated it because my dad, one of our first gifts was a mitt. And he used a hard ball. And that ball used to burn when he'd throw it fast. And I'd say, I don't want to play ball anymore. Catch the ball. So I like to do that. I love tetherball. We have a tetherball pool in our backyard. And I just wanted to hit it one time, and it would go all the way around so that the person couldn't hit it back. And we like to catch tadpoles. My mother would have died if she knew we were going to the Union Station down the train station, hopping between them trains, catching tadpoles. We go down there and buy hot water taffy. We had cut a hole in the park, in the baseboard, so we could wiggle through there and get on the grass because we knew what time the sprinklers were going to come on and run through the sprinklers. Ay, ay, ay. We used to climb to the top of the bleachers, the top, and jump off because we liked that electrical feel that went through. Crazy. So we didn't crack our ankles. That electric shock that went through your legs when you hit the ground, and then we go all the way back up. My mom playing ball with us. She was the only mother out there sliding in third base. I used to be so proud. But she belonged to the PTA. And she was an incredible baker. Oh. So every time she'd bake a cake that we had to take to school, I said, we need to hurry up and get there so we can buy the cake back. I don't want anybody to buy the cake. So one evening we were going to a PTA meeting. She had a cake. So, you know, back then, we didn't wear pants. So anytime you were going out, you had to put a dress on. So that means putting on the dress, taking that Vaseline, shining your legs, shining the shoes. and they had a little litany. Okay, did you wash your face? And I was so excited and wanting to get out the house. I just said, yeah, yeah. So, again, with the structure in the bathroom, everybody had their spot for the towel. She knew whose towel it was. And so we got there. We had a good time, bought the cake, and we got about 2 blocks from the house. And she said, well, when you get home, you're going to get a spanking. And my blood froze because that was, you know, they used a belt or a switch. And I said, well, why? And she said, because I asked you, did you wash your face before we left? And you said, yes, and I felt your towel. I mean, that's a little thing. But to her, you told a lie, and you were going to... I ran up them steps so fast, tried to get under the bed, but she had to talk to you for 20 minutes before she spanked you. But I can tell you, I have had no more than 5 whippings, because when they whipped you, whatever it was you did not do that again. Yeah, so even that wasn't, my dad didn't do any spanking. He would just tease you when you came out and tears were coming down, and he would look at you and say, how come you've been in there beating your mama? And I would, and you couldn't say anything to him, get smart with him, because, and then he would just burst out laughing, think it was funny. But we had a good childhood, we really do.
Okay, so this one's 3 parts. Who were your best friends? How often did you see each other? And what kind of things did you do together and talk about?
Well, actually, through the 8th grade, probably my sister, she's 18 months younger than me, she was my best friend. And like I said, our world kind of revolved around church, our family, my cousins. We were all close because, you know, we spent the night over each other's houses and that sort of thing. But my best friend I didn't get until after my mom died and we moved. And Carolyn Foster was my best friend. And then the other part of my crew was Gwen Roberts and Alicia Anderson. It's amazing, I remember that. But Carolyn and I just hit it off, you know. Her mother was a licensed vocational nurse. She was also a seamstress. And when we graduated from the 9th grade, she made us dresses alike. Mine was yellow, because that's my favorite color, and Carolyn's was white. And she became like a surrogate mom to me, so she made every dress for me through graduating from nursing school. When I went to the senior prom in 10th grade, she made my dress. In the 12th grade, she made my dress. When I went to nursing school the first day, she made my suit. When I got married, she made my wedding dress. And when I went to the graduation ball from nursing school, she made that dress. So Carolyn and I go way back. But she was my best friend. We did well. Her parents were a little bit better off, you know. I said my dad was a single parent, so she got a driver's license at 16. So, you know, we were able to go places. We were really into modern dance at the time, so she and I took modern dance together, and we would go to the recreation department during the week when my dad would let me go. And we took dance lessons from a pretty well-known dance instructor by the name of Ruth Beckford, who used to dance with Catherine Dunham and also had danced in Haiti. And I remember, you know, like we were in the 9th grade, and here she was wearing a short crop natural, and the boys used to laugh at her. I know we were going to dance, because back then, first of all, women weren't wearing the hair natural, and secondly, they weren't wearing it cut in a short natural. So we took dance together, we studied together. My father, you know, trusted me with Mrs. Roberts and Mrs. Anderson. So if we went on, school excursions. Like I remember once we went to Angel Island, which is out in the middle of the San Francisco Bay. Mrs. Foster would take us. We caught a shark that time. Yeah, it was little. It was only about 12 inches long. But I remember that. Just trying to think some of the other things we did. We were in the Big Sisters together. I remember that in the 11th grade. We mentored other high school students. She played in the band. She played the flute in the band. And we were very involved in our church. But I'm trying to think of some of the other things that Carolyn and I did. We were so... not pushed or coerced, but we were focused on gotta do well in school because we have to go to college. So we didn't do crazy stuff like regular teenagers did. You know, smoking, drinking. You know, I think I had my first boyfriend probably in 11th grade. And, you know, back then they had you thinking that you could get pregnant if you French kissed a boy. So you were just really scared. And my father's, the extent of the sex education was, as he's playing solitaire, not even looking at me, he said, if you get pregnant, you're going to go to the juvenile. That was it.
Wow. To the juvenile.
So there was a lot of respect for adults then, but if an adult told you something in your appearance, you did it. You know, not like now, you know. And I'm old school. I can't stand the way these young people talk to their parents, and my granddaughters, no, no, grandma's not having it, not at all. So they walk the straight and narrow with me. I'll tell them, no, you're not even talking to your mother like that, you know. Well, grandma, nope. I said, you better be glad that you didn't have my mother, because you'd have been pushing up them daisies. Oh, you guys smart back. It's a different time.
Which schools did you attend? Describe what they were like.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Elementary school, I went to Willa Manor. We were still living in the projects, but it was safe then. Let's see, that was 1953. So I walked probably 14th Street to 20th Street. It must have been a mile. As a kindergartner, I can remember walking to school. But again, it was safe then. I think I went to Willa Manor up until the third grade, and that's when we bought our house. We moved from West Oakland to North Oakland. Again, I told you that was the time that the whites were moving out, and we moved into an area that was predominantly Portuguese. And the Portuguese had moved to another white area, and we bought our home from a Portuguese family. And then I went to Longfellow Elementary. And I remember it was a three-story building. And we had an earthquake, I think when I was in the fourth grade. And the earthquake damaged the building. So we couldn't, they had to put portables out until they could build a new school. Yeah. And I was kind of a tomboy then. And I just remember having a fire drill once and standing outside that building when I was in the fourth grade. And I had two long braids. Remember, this is to braid our hair, two braids. And this boy came up and he was pulling my hair, saying he was milking a cow. And I turned around and I guess I must have hit him in the face. So back then you had to go to the principal's office and you would get the paddle. So I'm trying to tell them, you know, this is what happened, but they didn't want to hear it. If you were involved in any type of altercation, both of you were going to get in trouble. I didn't get the paddle that time, but, you know, once he called my mother, she was standing outside that door when I got home with the belt. They don't want to hear who started it, any of that. You shouldn't have been doing it in the first place. I did get the paddle once, though, at Willa Manor, because I don't know what this kid did to me, something. I know he threw a beanbag at me or something, and I brought my umbrella to school. I was kindergarten. Brought my umbrella to school and beat his little behind all over the go-kart, and that time I went to the paddle. I mean, went to the principal's office, and they used to put nail polish, red nail polish, in the center of the paddle, like you were thinking of blood or something silly. And I got the paddle, and then, of course, when I got home, I got another spanking. But elementary school, I loved. I loved, it's not really a merry-go-round, I don't know what you call that thing. But you you run and run and run, and then you jump on, and it keeps going around and around and around. They don't have those now.
I'm trying to think. Is that not a
merry-go-round? Yeah, maybe it is like a merry-go-round, but it's just, it's probably as big as that section there. But it stands still until you get on it, and you have to run and make it go around, then you jump on, and you ride. So a whole lot of kids would have to get on, like 5 or 6, and make it move. I love the Jungle Gym again. Going to the top of the Jungle Gym, dropping off, or hanging by my feet, and then flipping over. Crazy stuff. That's crazy.
So what about for middle and high school?
Of course, when I got to junior high, you were a little bit more sophisticated. You had homeroom and going to 6 different classes, and the boys started kind of paying attention to you then, so you sort of came out of the tomboyish. Actually, in the 7th grade, I got a job. We lived down the street from the YMCA, and at that time the YMCAs were segregated also. So about 3 blocks from my house we had the quote colored YMCA, and they used the term colored back then. And there was a nursery school in there. And so my neighbor 3 blocks down ran the nursery, and so she offered me a job to come in after school, fold up the cots from the kids, help give them their snack, and then wash the cups and the dishes and fold the blankets and stuff and put them away. And my pay was 50 cents a day. It probably took me an hour and a half. And so every Friday I would go to her house and she would give me $2.50. So after doing that for about 6 months, I said, there's about 30 kids in there. I have to fold all those cots and then put them in that big cabinet. And so I decided I was going to ask her for a raise. So I get up the nerve to ask her for this raise. I go and knock on her name. It's Mrs. Smith. And she looked at me and she just laughed and she said, "Baby, go home." And she closed the door. Yeah. But my mom was a tither, see? So that $2.50, I had to put 25 cents in church. And that was, everybody's putting pennies and nickels in. I had to put a whole quarter in. But my mother was a tither. And I remember, you made any money, you had to put a 10% in church. Yeah, so my junior high years, that's when the 8th grade, when my mom died, so that's when everything kind of got shook to the core. Then we moved in the 9th grade, and that's when I met Carolyn and went to a different junior high that last year, 9th grade I finished. And that's when I met Carolyn and kind of adopted her mom, and Alicia's mom, as my surrogate mothers, and it kind of all came together. Yeah. And high school, what kind of things did we do? Well, I'm trying to think. I had to come straight home from school, so. I did the modern dance. Like I said, I was a big sister. I don't want to say I was a teacher's pet, but I did well in school, so if you weren't a bad kid, the teachers kind of took to you. So I do remember, though, in the 11th grade, taking U.S. history, and we had a white, sort of prejudiced U.S. history teacher, and there was probably, at my high school, it was half and half, well, 50% white and black. And the class was probably a third of us were black, and we were just sitting on pins and needles when it got to the black history part. It wasn't that we were ashamed, but it just wasn't comfortable hearing it come from his mouth and watching the reaction of the other white students, because it isn't something that had really been discussed a lot when we were growing up. Except 1957, when they had the unrest in Little Rock. Since my parents are from Arkansas, my mother would make us watch that, about the water hoses and sicking the dogs on them and that sort of thing. But I just remember that in U.S. history, that I just kind of froze and like, oh, I hope he hurries up and get through that section, because it's hard to explain, but it was just... maybe it was kind of bordering on shame that we didn't want to discuss it because we didn't know a whole lot about African history. I didn't even know about black colleges. There was a girl in my English class in the 12th grade, and she told me she was going to Bennett College, and I said, Bennett College? I've never heard of Bennett College. She said, oh, yeah, it's all black girls' school. And it's either North or South Carolina. And so then I started inquiring, and I looked into Howard, because we were looking at schools to go to. And most of the kids that I went to school with, they were either going to UC Berkeley or San Francisco State, schools close around, but... one of the girls said, well, you know, if you're going to go to Howard, they're going to do the paperback test on you. And I said, what is the paperback test? They said, if you're darker than that paperback, they're not going to take you. And they always want you to send your picture. So this is what I'd heard about Howard. But other than that, never heard of Florida A&M or Spelman or Morehouse or any of that. None of those colleges. My father talked about Shorter College. You know, in the Methodist colleges in Arkansas, but I never heard of the black colleges. So, of course, I went to an all-white nursing school, not knowing that it was all white till the first day I got there. And I'm looking around, and so I called my father. I said, I don't think I'm going to be able to stay here. He said, I'll come. I said, there's nobody here that looks like me. He said, well, you got that scholarship. You have to stay, blah, 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 blah. I said, I don't know. So the young lady that I beat out of the scholarship, she got accepted there too. So they were going to put me in a room by myself. They said, well, maybe you should be in a room by yourself. You get to know people, blah, 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 blah. And then Regina said, well, we can room together. So we did room together, and I didn't know that she was atheist. So back in those days, you know, people stand up, sit down. I mean, they stand up, they sit in a chair and pray, but rarely, unless you go south, do you see people get on their knees. You don't see people around here get on their knees too much. But back then, if we pray, you got on your knees. And so every night, I got on my knees saying my prayers, and she would just mock me like, oh, that's so stupid, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, she flunked out after four. She had 4.0, but she flunked out because nursing is a healing art. And if you don't want to touch people, you got a problem. You got a problem. We started off with 66 in our class. I think we graduated 42. Because they come there for different reasons. Some girls came only because their mother said, go there and find a husband, a white, you know, a rich doctor. And I have classmates to this day, they never worked. Their whole thing was to find a doctor. Because that's the way they were trained. But I knew that I was called to do that. You know, my mother died at home. And like I said, I was 13 years old. I had no idea what I was doing, but I grabbed for her pulse before the ambulance got there. And I took care of my brothers and sisters, so it was just natural that I went into nursing. But I saw a lot of them couldn't touch a patient, would just freak out if they had to rub a bath. Or, you know, men did silly things like flash at you just to see the reaction of the student nurse. And I would just come back at them and say, well, is that all you got, you know? But that was an experience, too. That was rough because I had not been in an all-white environment. Like I said, I had always gone to mixed schools, and here, right in my town. But they, again, racism was alive and well. They took one black student per class. When I was a senior, it was the first time they took two black students. And everyone had a mentor. One of the professors was your mentor. And I lucked out that mine wasn't a nursing instructor, but she was the nutritionist on staff. She was from South Carolina. She had written our nutrition book, Sue Rodwell Williams. And her husband was a minister. So she was really good to me, because every time I wanted to go into the office and quit, I said, I just don't know if I can deal with this racism. So how I got through nursing school was the nursing assistants, the porters, the housekeepers, the black women who worked in the kitchen, because when they would see me coming or come down the hall, their faces would light up like I felt like Jackie Robinson, like I'm doing this for them too. And I know I'd go through the cafeteria and they would give me more. And sometimes I remember once I think there were two black nurses in the whole hospital. And this one pediatric nurse was such instructor, so racist. And she just liked to just be on you constantly. And so I went into the linen room, and I think I must have shed a tear. And before I knew it, one of the black nurses came up and grabbed me from behind, and she said, "I don't care what they say to you or what they do to you, don't you ever let them see you cry. You come talk to us." So, you know, I'd see them in the hallway, and they'd say, "You know, we're praying for you. We know you can do it. Don't let them get you down," you know, because their whole thing was, let me flunk as many of these girls. And nursing is still that way. Nurses eat their young. So it's still that way. Let's see how many we can flunk out of here. I know on three different occasions I got into that dean's office. I'm out of here. And then she'd say, "Well, how can we help you?" And I'd say, "Oh, I'd make up something." Because that tape would start in my head. And my mother, "You know, you don't want to have to be a domestic. You know, I don't want you to have to clean white people's toilets the way I did." You know, sometimes she would take me to work with her. And she would just show me. You know, she said, "You see, we pull the couch back there. They put the $10 bill there. They put it there on purpose to see if I'm going to take it. But I'm going to vacuum back there and I'm going to push the couch right back." You know, or they just were slubbing. Just leave their clothes all over the place just because they knew somebody was coming to clean it for $7 a day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she used to clean a 29-room house in 3 days for $7 a day. I'm telling you, black women have... When you see that dance "Cry" by Alvin Ailey, it's about just the hardships of black women through. I mean, it's real, and I see it in South Africa. I said, "Lord, every continent I go on, black women are carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders." But I got through my first... What's that? My surgical rotation. The professor said to me, he said, "Well, you know, I never saw a black person until I was 16. Blah, 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 blah." So I said, "Oh, okay." So I went on the rotation, and they have in operating room a circulating nurse. And the circulating nurse has to be a registered nurse. She's responsible to see if anybody breaks technique, if the doctor rubs his nose or whatever. Okay, we got to change your glove. Or she has to do the count of the needles, the swabs that they use. She's circulating, so she knows everything that's going on. But the people who pass the instruments don't have to be registered. They can be techs. And so this particular tech was a black man. And it was my turn to learn to scrub. And I'll never forget, it was a bilateral hernia repair, which means on both sides. He looked at me and he said, "You're going to scrub better than any of them other girls on this rotation. You got it?" I said, "I got it." So they pushed me to make me excel in that area. But when it came time for the grades, she gave everybody an A and she gave me a C. I was devastated. And even the white girl said, "Wow, please, we know you aced this. You did much better than us." So back then, you had to sign for the grade, and I refused to sign for the grade. So we had to go to the dean, and they were trying to work it out. To this day, I haven't signed for that grade. I refused. She refused to change it, and I refused to sign for it. But it was just blatant racism. And while I was on, these things are coming back to me now, while I was on my surgical rotation, I don't know, you're too young, maybe you never heard of the Black Panthers and Huey Newton.
No, okay. I love
the Black Panthers. Okay. Well, Huey Newton got shot while I was on my surgery rotation. And I was at a private hospital, Kaiser Foundation. Well, that was the nearest hospital, and they brought him in there. And so the white nurse that was on duty in the emergency room did not give him any care for 15, 20 minutes. Okay, now, gunshot wound to the abdomen, 95% of them die. So he survived, and then moved him to the county hospital where I went to work after I graduated. But I remember going to surgery the next day, and one of the white anesthesiologists said, so I can hear it, "If I had been on duty that night, I would have let that nigger die." And the only reason that he survived, that I've always said, was because there was one female surgeon. There weren't that many women doctors then. We had three in the whole hospital. And her name was Esther Nagal. I'll never forget her. They disrespected her, and she was a full-blown surgeon. And the interns used to disrespect her. I was on one of the cases once, and she asked him to do something, and he didn't do it, and she took one of the instruments and whapped his hands, because they figured, well, she's a woman, we can disrespect her even though we're an intern. And she was on call that night and she saved his life. That's how he survived. And plus he went to the county hospital and there was one black head nurse at a private hospital in Berkeley. I'm sure you've heard of Berkeley, where UC Berkeley is. She left her job to go over there and take care of him because he was shackled. He was shackled to the bed. That's coming back to me now. So I went through all of that in nursing school. Unbelievable. And then I married like a dummy in my junior year in nursing school. I was there. He was at San Francisco State. Well, of course, if you're both in school, who's concentrating on the marriage? Well, that didn't last very long. About 3 years. But if I had to do all over again, I would still go to a diploma school. Business nurses these days are not being trained. They learn how to be a nurse after they get out of school. But back then, Monday and Tuesday was 8 to 4:30. You had 8 hours of theory on Monday and 8 hours of theory, like classes, you know, with lectures. And then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday was 24 hours. You got 3 tours on the floor. So they're usually like slave labor. Education was cheaper, so, you know, we had to do everything. And so the nurses loved to see us coming, because we was doing all their work. So, you know, we had to, I went to autopsy, I put stitches in, I gave meds, I did everything that a regular RN does. They taught us how to start IVs, put in catheters, all of that. So when I graduated, all I had to do was get a job and go to work. Not now. When they graduate, they got to buddy with somebody. 6 months. I mean, I've worked with too many new nurses now, and they may go on the ward for 4 hours and they're looking. And plus, the nurse practitioner that I work with at the VA, she had a degree in business, and they have some kind of bridge program at Vandy, and she wasn't even a nurse. And she went for a year or two to take that nurse practitioner. It's like they just primed her to take the test. And she was so efficient, inefficient. Me and her were at loggerheads all the time because I knew she didn't know nursing. But she was able to pass the board because of that bridge. So I'm saying, what are you doing? People go into it now because it's good pay. You always have a job. People are going to be sick. And some people like the power, telling other people what to do. But it is a healing art to touch people and make them feel better and make them feel well. Because most of the time, a big percentage of illness comes from okay, it is not physiologic, it's psychological. So if you can, you know, give comfort in that area, I've taken care of too many people. And just a smile, a touch, it's something that makes them feel better. I mean, just being there at the VA, I think of Mr. Barnes and him saying, Kamuzi, I can't eat all my food. And I said, I know, honey, what did I tell you? You said I don't have to eat it all. I said, no, you don't. Eat what you can. I told him this every day. Every day I told him the same thing. And my coworkers were saying, I'm going to tell him that. He knows all about it. They would just be fussing. But he needed that reassurance. And when you look back on his history, he had been taken advantage of. Somebody's hitting him and beating him because he didn't clean the plate. When he first came to us, he was rolling around on the floor. You know, so horrible, horrible memories of how they've been treated. So it is a healing art, and it's a gift. And I don't see that now. You get sick and go in the hospital, you better have somebody with you. You better have your family with you. Somebody. There are some good nurses there, but they have stretched so thin that they can't concentrate on the healing part of it. All of it is now task oriented. Get the task done. Get the task done. Don't worry about the person there in the bed. Just get the task done. And it's really sad. It's really sad. That's why I love it when I go to a foreign country. I mean, like when I was in South Africa, they're so happy that, oh, you'll come to see about us. And I'm looking and I'm saying, Lord, this is so easy. What they have, so easy to fix here at home. But they don't have the infrastructure or the nurse. They have a mobile nurse. At least they don't have that in Haiti. But they have a mobile nurse and she comes once a month. And I was there on Friday and she had just been there Tuesday. I'm saying, well, your blood pressure is like 170 over 120 and you really need to go to the hospital. No, we can't go to the hospital unless we get the referral from the nurse. So I'm looking at the blood pressure, and I'm saying, well, what about your pills? And he had the package. It was empty. And I said, well, how come you're not taking your pills? He said, well, I feel okay. I don't need taking pills no more. And I said, and that's why they call it the silent killer, because you do feel okay. But it's dinging your heart, your kidneys. And, well, do you have some medicine for me? I said, sir, I wish I did, but I do not. But I'm going to talk to Pastor Musa and see if he can get you into the hospital so you can get your prescription. So, and then I was really frustrated that evening because I'm saying everybody I saw, from the insulin to this to that, you know, to the amputee, to the person with AIDS, it's just getting them into that infrastructure, because they're a new country, 20-something years old, and everything is new, and there's so many sick people. And so they have to kind of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, we know you're all sick, but we got to take the 5s. I mean, you may be a 1 and hurting really bad, but we got to take the 5s. So, yes, your blood pressure is high. You've probably been walking around with that like that for 3 months. But this is a person over here that's probably got 6 months to live, and they're dying with HIV. So, and one of the ministers explained it to me. He said, Kamisa, sometimes it's good to be in that area where you feel so helpless. Like, you know, you could do something, you could fix this, but you're not able to. He says, that's when you know you have to rely on God, because He's the ultimate one that's going to take care of it. And these people are actually walking miracles, and they are. Like I say, walk around like that for months, you know, walking sick. And God takes care of them. So it helps me to put it into perspective that, yes, He may have given me these skills to do this and this and this, but I can only do so much, and then I, too, have to rely on that He'll do the rest. So I love it. I've been doing this, you know, when I retired last year, I've been a nurse 47 years. But I still love it. You know? And I'm going to go back out there, even though I was traumatized by the VA. I think of Mr. Barnes, because I gave him my word that I was coming back to volunteer, and he said, you're not coming back here. I know when you get out of here, you ain't coming back here. But I had to stay away for a year, because working for the government, it was just, I've never seen anything like that. It's crisis management. They don't do anything until the people are at the death's door, and so they don't understand preventative medicine. And, you know, I spent my whole career in preventative medicine, so I go here and like, this is so easy. How come you guys, why do you have to go through all this red tape? And I never seen a pharmacist that tells a doctor what to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the pharmacist has the last word on what medicines physicians can use, because of the budget. You know, it's not what's best for the patient, it's the budget. You know. So, life is cheap out there. But anyway, that's a whole other story. That's a whole other story.
Can you give me a sense of how a typical day would go at school? How would they begin, and what would they be like along the way for K through 12?
Let's see. I'll take 7th grade. We, in those days, had homeroom. And so the day would begin in homeroom. I remember my homeroom teacher was Mrs. Gibson. And she would have all the announcements. And, of course, this was our first experience after coming from grammar school, like going to English was one class, geography, you know, algebra. Gym was required back then. And so I remember we had a blue gym suit, and we had a top, and the shorts had elastic in them, but they would come mid-thigh. You had to, every girl had to embroider her name on the lapel, or no, I'm talking about the top of the pocket on the gym suit. So we would have to go to first period, go to second period, maybe third period was my gym. So I had to put all my books in my locker. I had to go to the gym. They had little dressing rooms. You had to undress, leave all your clothes there, put your gym clothes on, then run laps, play basketball or whatever. Then you had to come back, take a shower, lock your gym clothes up in your gym locker, and then go back to the regular building, open up your big locker, get your things out, and complete the day. Yeah. Lunchtime was, we had closed campus. I never left campus the entire time through secondary school, all the way through high school, like these kids do now. So cafeteria time was split up into two different times. Like some people went from 11:30 to 12:15. Another group went from 12:15 to 1. They usually, I guess, separated them by lower and higher grades. Ninth graders probably went second. And you'd take your lunch or buy your lunch. And I used to like spaghetti. And I remember you could get a scoop of mashed potatoes and a scoop of spaghetti on this big thing like this for 50 cents. And then I didn't have pizza. I had vegetables and meat and didn't have a salad bar. Of course, we had milk, graham crackers, no chocolate milk. So that was kind of the routine day. And then, of course, going home, changing clothes, doing your chores. And if it was daylight saving time, you know, you could play outside, but I would have to go to the Y after school and work in the nursery until 5 o'clock, and then I would go home. But it was very inclusive, the community. You know, your church was in the community. The grocery store was in the community. The school was in the community. The Y was in the community. Now, because our church was probably 6 miles away, it was difficult for us to get there to get to Sunday school. So there was a church one block away that my mother made us go every Sunday to Sunday school. In fact, that's where I was baptized when I was 10 years old. Then we had to run home so we'd get the car and go to church at our church. But our lives, our community was enclosed. Now, when we didn't have a Safeway or a Public or anything like that in the neighborhood, you had corner grocery stores that had, we lived next door to the corner grocery store, and it was a Japanese run store. So they had, you know, the canned goods, the dairy, and they had a row of vegetables, and then you had a big, along the back was a meat market. So everything was there. We just bought the meat and stuff because we had a garden in the backyard, and everybody grew their stuff. But when we wanted to go to the big market, they had a big market in downtown Oakland, and it was where the black people went. And it was interesting, when I went to South Africa, they had the same thing. It's called Victoria Market. And they had a huge market just for the coloreds and the blacks. And across the street was the English market. You know, but that was the only place they could shop. And sort of reminded me when I was growing up of going to what we call 10th Street Market. And that's where all the black people met up every Saturday. And they had these men that lined up. They charge you a dollar to give you a ride home. It's sort of like the Lexington Market, if you've ever been to Baltimore. Yeah, it's like the Lexington Market. It reminds me of that. You know. But as far as going to a restaurant, I don't ever remember going to a restaurant until I was... Actually, when I went to the proms, because we didn't go to restaurants. We went to families' home to eat. Or if we went to a wedding or a funeral or something like that. But, you know, that was kind of the extent of that.
What other things do you remember about your time as a school child? Are there specific experiences, events, or moments that stick out in your mind?
I remember in kindergarten or first grade, this clown came to our class. And somehow I took a picture with him and it ended up in the Oakland Tribune. So I had my picture in the newspaper. I remember that. I remember May Day, because we always made a maypole. I don't know if they do that now, where we move around the maypole. And I remember Halloween. Oh my goodness. Halloween was a big thing because, you know, back then you could go trick-or-treating with his pillowcase because it was safe. Although my mother still had to go throw all the candy, but people gave you apples, I mean, that kind of stuff, and you didn't have to throw everything away because you thought a razor was going to be in it. But, yeah, I remember that's when I started my Menses. On Halloween, because my brother said to me, "What's wrong? Did you sit in some jam or something on the back of your pants?" I remember that Halloween. I was 12. But my mother wasn't afraid. She let us go trick-or-treating. directly in front of our house was a Church of God in Christ. Like, this was a block, and then right across here was a Church of God in Christ, and on this other end was a Seventh-day Adventist church. And I used to think those are the most... I used to sit on the porch when I was looking at the clouds, and I'd be looking at those women, and I said, those are the most beautiful women that don't have any makeup or jewelry, you know. And I love the music at the Church of God in Christ, because, you know, growing up in Baptist church, we had a piano and an organ. But over there, they had drums and a guitar, and I used to beg my mother, I was in elementary school, to let me go across the street, and she'd say, are you sure? I said, yeah. And I just go up there by myself and sit in the very back row. And I just love the music and the shouting. And I remember this lady, her name was Helen Hunt. I must have been about 12. She had an incredible voice, incredible voice. But I remember going to school in elementary school and junior high with a lot of the kids that were Kojic, as you call it, Church of God in Christ. And they were... You know, we weren't allowed to wear pants, but they wore long skirts almost down to their ankles. And how the kids would laugh at them, you know. Even up in high school, they would laugh at them because they didn't wear makeup. And they used to call them holy rollers and say all the negative things about them. And I think about that now, and I said, now everybody's got their praise on. But when they were having their praise on, it was funny. Because I grew up half Baptist and half Methodist, so when I would go to church with my grandmother, it was like, whoa, you can hear a rat peeing on cotton and hear it so quiet. I did not like go to that quiet church. But now everybody is, so I said, they got the last laugh. Because it was about praising, but I've always been into music. And when I wanted to play the piano so bad, so bad, so bad, I asked the... Sunday school teacher at church. I said, will you play, teach me how to play the piano? She said, do you have a piano at home? I said, no, but I'll come here every day and practice. And I couldn't do it. And when I graduated from nursing school and I got my job, the first thing I bought was a piano. And I took lessons for 6 months, and I'll never forget. The lady asked me to hit middle C or something, and I hit the wrong note, and she actually took a ruler and hit my hand. I said, oh, no, I'm not 10, I'm 12, I'm 21. So I sort of got over that, but I saw that all my girls play piano, and they all play proficiently. That was my dream deferred, because I really wanted to play the piano. So, let's see. I always get off the subject, I go on something else. But... But those are the things. I'm trying to remember what else I remember from high school. I remember the, is this junior high or any time in school?
Any time in school.
Yeah, I remember the football games that I was allowed to go to. Like I said, I went to a school that was half white and half black, but there was a black high school sort of on the other side of town, more in the hood. And they had a reputation for, if we don't win the game, we're going to win the fight. So you could never stay to the end of the game, because if you won, they was going to whip everybody. And went to that school and chase you home.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And we used to go to the what we call a tournament of champions. Those were all the high schools competed. That was a lot of fun. I was on the yearbook staff. I don't know if I was ever on the newspaper staff, but I know I was on the yearbook staff. Belonged to the French club, you know. We were college bound. We were college bound. Everybody back then thought of, unless something happened, like one of my crew got pregnant in the 11th grade. And back then, if you got pregnant, your parents made you marry. So Gwen had to get married and get an apartment. Of course, the marriage didn't last, but she never wavered. She graduated with honors. She went on to college, and she became an engineer. So out of the four of us, we got one nurse, an engineer, and two teachers. Yeah, so it was expected. You are going to college. Whereas now, it's I think life has people so busy. You're so busy. I've got to pay for this, and got to do this, got to do this. So the kids kind of get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
And when I was living in California, so many of my friends, because you want to keep a certain type of lifestyle, they had to work two jobs. So if you're working two jobs, then the kids are raising themselves. You know, so that's one of the reasons I came here, to help my daughter with the grandkids. You know, because my friends in California thought I'd lost my mind. You moving where? To Tennessee. Why did somebody live in California move to Tennessee? But I love it here. I miss the ocean. I do miss the ocean. And I'm going home in 2 months, but I do love it here. So it's a much better quality of life for a lot cheaper.
How long have you been living here?
Going on 7 years. Not long. I moved here when, what was I, 60? Yeah. I never thought I'd leave California. Never. You couldn't have told me that. But I was getting a little burnout on my job, and the doctors were piling more and more on us, and I just said, I don't know if I can do this another 5 years. And my daughter said, well, you said you're a woman of faith. Take the leap. So I rented my house out. I had already built a house here like 4 years prior to that. I built it, what they call a duet, a zero lot line, so my daughter's on one side and I'm on the other. To keep her from hopping from place to place to place with my grandkids. So she's been stationary now for 11 years. But I would just come. It was my respite place. I would just come and just relax and then go back and get into the grind. So I moved here thinking, oh, the VA will be like Kaiser. Well, was I wrong? No. But anyway, I had to get the Blue Cross card, so I had to swallow a lot of stuff to get that Blue Cross card. But, you know, be out here 65 without something. I'm not going to just, you know, depend on Medicare. No, that's not happening. So, but that's how I got here. Grandchildren. And my daughter didn't think, I never thought she'd leave. But Verizon closed, and they let everybody go except for her and another person, and they gave her an option of 6 cities. And she was going to go to Tampa, and she's definitely afraid of bugs, and somebody told her they had flying roaches, and so that was out. So she came to Nashville. She flew here in a matter of 3 days. She had an apartment. She got it. A washer and dryer. She got her electricity turned on, the tags for her car, and her and my grandbaby were gone. My grandbaby's 2 years old, and my daughter's not like to fly. So I was coming here at least every 3 months to see my grandchild, you know. And I just kind of fell in love with her. She was in Antioch at the time. And then I found the place out here. But, so that's how I got here. But the other two said, mm-mm. Now the youngest twin would like to move here. But that, the one that married the boy from D.C., no. No. She said, everything looks the same here. She lives in Maryland. And I said, there's too many people there for me. She said, nope, I'm never moving there. I said, okay. Don't ever say never. You don't know where you're going to end up.
That's true. That is very true. How far did you travel to get to school, and how did you get there?
Let's see. We lived on 35th Street. In elementary school, I think I probably walked about a half a mile. And one of the streets was kind of busy, but we had those, what do you call them? Traffic guards. And then in junior high, it was even closer. Probably about 4 blocks. In high school, I had to take the bus. But I had to walk like 5 blocks to catch the school bus, which was 10 cents, instead of the city bus, if you caught what they called was the school bus, was 10 cents. But if I walked, it's probably a mile and a half in high school. And I was in college. The dorm was down the street from the hospital, so it was probably like equivalent of a block and a half. But I never had a car. I didn't get a car until I was 23. So I had graduated from nursing school and became a professional nurse, and I was riding the bus and didn't think nothing of it. People rode the bus then. Now they got to have a car at 15. Yeah, so I never thought about it. I had to be at work at 7 o'clock. I got there on time, left. But I lived in a city that had a bus coming every 10 minutes or less. So when you come here, I'm like, what? It's not a bus. So we had a really good transportation. They even had buses going down major streets that, like, if we had the 80, the 81, and the 82, and the 83, the 83 stopped every 2 blocks. the 81, maybe something, but the 80 was the, what would you call it? I guess the rapid transit, because it would only make 1, 2, 3, so you know that you were going faster. But when I was in nursing school now, when we were going to the junior college to get our AA degree, it was in another town. So we had our own private bus that came to our nursing school and picked us up and drove us probably 20 miles to the junior college. And that was sometimes traumatic because we got all these people getting off the bus and the black kids are standing watching and they see me the only one get off the bus and they're like, what is she doing getting off that bus with all of them? So that's a whole nother story. I forgot about that. Yeah. And then my boyfriend got a car, so I didn't want to get on that bus, so he would come and pick me up and drive me all the way to college. And I didn't want to get off that bus because the kids, they would just make it their thing to be there to see me get the point. I'm like, what's she doing about? You know. And all this stuff is coming back to my memory now. I forgot about that. But yeah, I used to say, oh, I got to get off this bus. Why can't I be the first one to get off? But you know, I got that all the time. I got that from them. I got it from the whites when we had to go on different rotations. Like when we went to the VA hospital, it was in a different town. But the nursing school had 9-passenger station wagons. And so a lot of the girls could drive. I didn't have a driver's license. So like when I went to my psych rotation, it was at the VA. So the 9 of us would get in the station wagon and drive. So they'd see me, you know, only a little ink spot getting out the car, like, what was she with them? You know, but, you know, I'm used to that. I mean, my whole career mostly has always been working with opposites. You know, not that many black professional nurses have I worked with. I think I work with more here at the VA than I have my whole career. My previous job for 14 years as a diabetes educator, I was the only black when on the team. So I was used to that. Because I'm going to be me wherever I am. And I was the crazy one because I was always the one telling them, nope, not doing that. And I would not allow them to talk about this segment of the population versus that part of the segment population. Now, they might do it when I wasn't there. But in my presence, I would say, no, we're not having that. No, don't tell me about that hospital in Oakland versus this one here. Because you want to get a litany from Kamisi that people are people. It has nothing to do with their color. If you're poor, you're going to exhibit some of the same traits and you're going to do some of the same thing. Because it's just, that's what people do when they don't have any purpose and people don't allow them to get up. I see it in Haiti. I see that 1 or 2% that like to keep their foot on their neck and keep them down, you know. So, and people in this country don't realize that it's one of the few places where there is a middle class. Most of the world, there's no middle class. You either have it or you don't. And it used to be that way right here until 1940s when they started building them cars in Michigan, for General Motors Chrysler. That's where the middle class started after the war and with the GI Bill and people could buy houses. Before then, rich and poor. Now, they need our help. That's a mission field. Are you going to help them? Detroit was the number, in 1951, it was the number 2 city behind New York City. You would never know that now. Now it has 50% unemployment rate and you've got blocks and miles of empty houses. Beautiful homes that you would never see in any part of the country. Yeah. Yeah. Because the factories are closed up and people don't have any jobs. So, when you don't have any jobs, what do you do? Crazy stuff. You know, to feed your family, to you're angry, all these other emotions that come out. So it's the same anywhere you go. Mexico, China, anywhere. Africa, when people are poor, they're going to do some of the same stupid stuff. You know, so, but not my team. They want to think, oh, but it's just because in that part of town, blah, 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 blah. So that's a whole nother ball game there, too, that they would just shake their head at me. No, not doing that. Well, why do you want to go to Haiti? Aren't you scared you're going to get hepatitis or AIDS? And I said, well, could I get it here? You use the same type of protection. I don't know if these people have it. You use the same kind of protection wherever you are. So when I said, and you are an endocrinologist, went to Harvard, and you're going to sit there and answer that stupid question. hotel. My coworker would say, Camisi, your face says you can't stand Sue. She says she's stupid. Just says stupid things like, oh, Camisi, what are the girls? And she was my endocrinologist because I had a goiter, I had to have surgery. And she would say, what are the girls doing this summer? And I'd say, well, Billy's on fellowship in Barbados, and somebody was doing something. You know, they always were doing something in Howard. And she says, well, that's good. At least they're not on the street selling drugs. And I would say, what did you say? Stupid. Went to Harvard, but that's kind of stuff. Oh, but I didn't really mean it that way, I'd say.
Wow.
Yeah. Or we'd be talking in a group, and I'd say, hey, you're talking about something. I'd say, oh, I just bought a KitchenAid mixer. And they look at me, you bought a KitchenAid? You can afford a KitchenAid? Well, why wouldn't I be able to afford a KitchenAid? You know, so I lived through all of that. But I just tell them off and keep it moving. And my manager at the VA said, Camisi, we just want you to retire. We just want you to retire. Can I be telling people what you're not going to do? I said, yes, I can. I can. If it's not right, I'm not going to do it. Don't tell me it's the VA way. I'm not going to do it. You know, there is a world outside of this building. And if I get called into court, they're not going to ask me about the VA way. They want to know what are the standards. I know the standards outside this place. Maybe you guys don't. So I constantly told them, no, you better ask somebody else. I'm not doing that. Mm-mm. It's not right. But they're so scared they're going to get fired. And I said, how are they going to fire you? Just go to Channel 2. I was a crazy one from California. I said, we go to the media. These people, this is a different mentality here. So they're coming along, I think, because so many different cultures are coming here now, and this is a college town, and you got education, but some of these people, they believe everything they hear on Fox News. I never known about no Fox News till I moved here, and I'll turn the channel in a minute to NSC and CNN. They're looking at me like, oh, she's that California liberal. Just ignorant, so anyway. Okay, next question. I can see where this takes 4 hours.
In regards to the way that you traveled to school, you said you walked in mm-hmm. elementary and junior, and then in high school you took the bus sometimes. Was that the same way that all the other kids in your area got to school?
Mm-hmm. Very few people were driven by their parents. Not like now. People drive their kids to school because they're afraid somebody's going to snatch them. My granddaughter's 20 years old, and she's never walked to school. My other granddaughter's 13, and she's never walked, and my daughter says they never will walk. We found out that somebody was a predator or whatever. You know, that goes around the subdivision like a grass fire. I don't think the man raped anybody, but it was something about some, pornography, some kind of pictures or whatever. But now the man is labeled, and so my neighbors all come in. Did you know he lives? That man been living there for 2 years. He just comes in. Well, I just wanted to tell you because you got this granddaughter here and blah, blah, blah. My daughter works out the home, so may come straight home, but everybody operates out of fear now. And fear just keeps you locked in. You know, I can't be afraid of stuff. I got up the other day because I forgot. She goes out the front door, and if I don't get up right away to lock it. So I got up yesterday morning, and I said, you know, me and these dogs have been here all night with this front door unlocked. She said, Mom, I said, I know the Lord takes care of me, but it's on a safe street. I lost my keys once, and they were in the door for 3 days. I said, I tore that house up. So she said, Mom, did you look at the front door? I said, I didn't leave my keys in the front door. Sure it is.
Wow.
Because if I have everything I need, I don't come out the house. I read or watch TV if I have all the food I need. And I didn't come out that time. I think I had 4 days off, and the keys were in the door. And you can see them hanging. I mean, my neighbors, anybody walking by, could see them hanging. But it's obviously safe, or God's taking care of me, so nobody bothered me. So that would never happen in California. No, not in California. You know, when I first moved here, I kept saying, Camisi, you always lock the door when you get out. You lock the door. Because that's a habit in California. You locked the door, you know, but And when I go to Arkansas, they don't lock nothing. And my cousin will leave and go to Michigan for 3 or 4 months to do taxes. And there's some rowdy kids down the street. And he said, if anything's missing in my house, even if you didn't do it, you did it and I'm coming after you. Everything better be just like out here. They, you know, they carry guns down there, so they don't play. So. We are spending a lot of time in childhood.
Yes. There's multiple sections. Let's see. Uh-huh. After childhood, there's family. And what else we got? Community, culture, cross-cultural, community again, and then the conclusion.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. What was special about your school in your eyes? This is still K through 12.
It was special. I think the special thing throughout secondary education was the teachers. They had a really vested interest in us. I keep going back to Miss Bass. I love Miss Bass, even though she would send you to the board with that pointer. And I love long division, but you know, they didn't hit you, but she would just tap you on the shoulder if you missed it. And then if the boys acted up, she could grab him by the back of the collar and say, no, we ain't having that. But the teachers, I remember Mr. Treadwell was the vice principal. His wife, Mrs. Treadwell, was the gym teacher. And you had just such utmost respect for them that, wow, they got to college, they did all this. And it wasn't, we hope you go, you know, it was, this is what's expected of you, and you better do it, and you better do well, but it was the teachers. But I really, really remember her. We did something different that year, that I was in the fifth grade, and this was the first time they had an experiment of mixing the classes. So when I was in the fifth grade, it was half fifth grade, half sixth grade. So when I went to the sixth grade, I had her. You know, but the fifth graders learned sixth grade stuff, and the sixth graders, she taught seventh grade stuff. We had this report due on the United Nations, and I think that's when I love history. I fell in love with history. And I was the only one, because she was very, better dot every I and cross every T. And anything was wrong, it wasn't perfect. I was the only one who got an A on that project in the sixth grade. And I just loved her so much, I just wanted to be like her. And then, just like in a flash, I changed. Like, oh, I'm so worried. How am I going to go to college? How am I going to afford to go to college? I can't go to college. And my dad's looking at me like, it's not a big deal. You graduate from high school, you just go get a job at a bank. No, I don't want to do that. So I think the scholarship came up. And back in those days, they didn't really tell us about scholarships. When they announced it in the homeroom, they had already called the other people down to the office to tell them about it. So that's how I found out about that. Regina told me. She was in my English class, and I went down to ask Mrs. Conley, and this happened to me. Oh, well, I don't think you'd really be interested in that. Maybe you want to do something with your hands. Like, cosmetology? She said, no. And I had to just keep pushing. She didn't want to give me the application. And then I got it. And I beat her out of it. But there were some teachers I hated too. One was a French teacher. She had all black kids on this side, and all the white and Chinese over here, and she taught on that side like we weren't even there. And why we were so stupid to keep taking French? Because you had to have 3 years of French or 3 years of Spanish. Somebody should have told us, okay, California's next to Mexico. You need to take Spanish, not French. And I go to Haiti and I can say bonjour and comment allez-vous. I can't stand that woman. But it was a teacher. When I was a junior in, this is coming back to me, when I was a junior in nursing school, I was taking care of this elderly lady, and in walks Mrs. Bass, who was her mother. Now, I'm 20 years old, have not seen her since I was 12. And she looked up at me and she said, I always knew you was going to amount to something. Oh, that made my day. That just really made my day. She was so proud. She had one child. Her daughter was a dentist. and she had retired, and she was working downtown Oakland as a receptionist in her daughter's office. Yeah, but it was the teachers. And then even in nursing school, it was Mrs. Williams, the nutritionist. Anytime I would just feel down or depressed, I mean, she was always there for me, encouraging me. Still have the books she gave me. She gave me some spiritual books to read. And then, of course, the nutrition book that nurses have studied all over the country, she wrote. But she was so encouraging to me, you know. And she was a Southerner, so she understood racism. And so I could talk to her. Whereas, and God just opened that up, because I think I was the only one that had her as a counselor. All the other students had some of the nurses, you know. And she just gave it to me straight. And then one of my professors in nursing school, she was from Boston. You know, back then people were really inquisitive about other races. And so we kind of developed a friendship. She would come over me and my husband's house for dinner, and we would talk. And because Boston is a very segregated town. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's like Chicago. Blacks live here, Jews live here. It's very cut up, even now. Because when they desegregated the schools, they was doing more fighting in Boston, and I think they were doing in Mississippi. They did not want, and in Chicago too. But it was always teachers in my life. And then I got into nursing school, and what is nursing? 80% of it is teaching. You know, a lot of it is laying on hands, but even when you're laying on hands, you're teaching. My friend that I went to see today, and I took her lunch and supper, she had knee surgery on the 24th, and I told her, oh, I'm going to be out of the country. And then it takes me a while, you know, the time difference is 8 hours, and then being at 44,000 feet, it affects your head. So when I called her, she was in so much pain, but she didn't listen to me. I said, you don't go home after knee surgery. You go to a nursing, you know, skilled nursing facility for 4 days where you can get medicated, because this is all about this, and they want to send you home. So, you know, I gave her some tips and told her she needs to get into water therapy because she's holding herself back because she's so guarded about the pain. And I said, well, did they tell you that you could use Tylenol or Motrin in between the hydrocodone, the narcotics, so that, you know, if your pain scale is on a 1 to 10, don't wait till it gets to a 10 to take the medicine, because then it ain't going to work. It's going to take too long to work. You got to space it out. And then for that, you know, that I call it breakaway pain in the middle. And she said, oh, just since you've been talking to me 4 days, I feel so much better. I mean, she was walking without that walker today. And I said, no, you let that guy push you. You take 2 pain pills before you go to physical therapy. And you let him push him. But nurses will do that. The surgeon cut on you and just say, okay, it doesn't look like it's got infected. Have a nice life. You know, go back to your internist. But medicine's different now. They chop us all up into different parts and people don't communicate. Whereas when I went to school, one doctor took care of everything. Maybe had a surgeon, but it wasn't like it is now where go here for your thyroid, go here for the podiatry, go this and this. The GP did it all. So it's different. And then it's about money and prestige. It's, again, it's not healing art, but teachers have been the most significant in my life. You know.
What was the racial or ethnic background of your classmates and teachers?
Let's see. In my early, kindergarten through fourth grade, I had white teachers. Fifth, sixth, when I got to seventh and eighth, I had more black teachers. And then when I got to ninth grade, it was kind of half and half. And then when I got to high school, then it just did a flip-flop. Let's see. The black teachers I had was biology. Mr. Treadwell was vice principal then. It was predominantly white teachers then in high school.
Miss Bess, that we talked about a lot, was she white or black?
Oh, she's black. Yeah, back then, you know. My fifth and sixth grade was, she was a black teacher, but my kindergarten through fourth grade was white. But then five, six, seven, eight was predominantly black. Ninth grade, it started to break up. Yeah, and then in high school, I just remember Ms. Cook. Ms. Cook was the biology teacher. So for algebra, for math, for French, history, dance was black. And then a lot of those coaches, but, you know, like for football and all that, you know, they were black, and baseball coaches. But and then the vice principal. We did have counselors that were black. But in high school is where I saw the shift. And then, of course, when I got to nursing school, it was like, then I found out at that particular time, let's see, we had Highland. Like I said, most of the hospitals had their own nursing schools. So we had Samuel Merritt, Peralta, Highland, Kaiser, St. Luke. There was probably six of them. I was the only black student in the whole city.
In the city?
City. Yeah. And I remember I went in 66. In 67, Samuel Merritt, which is a big muckety-muck private hospital on what they call Pill Hill, because we have three hospitals up on a hill. And that hospital was originally started eons ago. There's a lake in downtown Oakland called Lake Merritt, and it was named after this doctor who was a Mormon. And he had put in the bylaws that no black students were to be accepted to that school. So when they had to do reorganization and reconstruction, they had to get money from the government. So to get money from the government, you got to move that clause. So I was a junior when Regina was accepted in 67. She was the first black to go to that school. They treated her horrible. Horrible. So much pressure on her that they flunked her out. But she came back and she finished. But I used to go over and try to encourage her. But she didn't have that support since it was a private white hospital and they didn't have that many black people working there, but where else was. Kaiser was a HMO and it was one of the first hospitals in Oakland to hire black doctors, to bring black people on staff. So it was a little kind of liberal, kind of broke up that mess. Even the county hospitals, black doctors weren't able to go. We had a small black hospital in the area where I live and the doctors weren't there, but my cousins were all born at home. The black doctors delivered them at home, and that was in the 40s and early 50s, you know, because they couldn't go to the hospital. Now, I was born at the county hospital, but because my parents' financial situation and they didn't have insurance, but my sister and brother were born at the private hospital because my dad had then got the job at Mabel Air and got insurance. And I was premature, so I was there for like 4 months. And my dad said it took 5 years to pay that bill off. But, you know, they had to pay it. Not like now. People just go get Medicare and have to pay the bill. Yeah. So, yeah, but I remember that. It was really, really hard for her. And then when I was a senior, they took two. And Debbie Prater was my little sister, because you always had a little sister. My big sister, when I was in nursing school, came from Redding, California, which is all white, sort of up in the Hicks. And when I met her, you know, she was kind of this, wow, those girls were just wild. They smoked, and they just drank, and would go up and down, you know, because we had mandatory study hours then. You had to be in your room behind that desk between 6:30 and 8:30. If you was going to flunk out of school, it's going to be on your own. And for a boy to come visit you, you had to get permission and all that stuff. So they used to sneak out the fire escape. Mm-hmm. And sneak back in. You know, I've never seen nothing like this. It's like, wow, these girls are wild. And so she would come and talk to me, and we were talking about, you know, grades, and how you had to have at least a 3.5 to get in school. And she, you know, she had a D in chemistry and got C's and all that stuff. And I'm saying, what? Yeah. So they got accepted with those kind of grades, but not me. So my mother used to tell me that. She said, you're going to have to do it twice as well and 100 times better just to even get in, but they're going to be at this level, but you got to be at this level. It's the same thing. You look at the president. He's the most brilliant man that ever sat in that office. Mm-hmm. And his wife's smarter than him. So you got to be. And Bush had brain damage from alcohol. But they put him in there just like they put Trump in there, because people are ignorant. They don't read and they don't understand. You know, that's why when they'd start talking that mess about Obamacare at work, I'd say, have you read the 3,000-page manual? Well, if you haven't, then you need to shut up. I don't want to discuss it because you don't know what you're talking about. You're just talking what you heard O'Reilly say. So, and they'd say, don't talk about that stuff around Kamisa. She gets upset. You don't have the facts. You need to shut up. But anyway, that's the kind of world we live in. So, yeah, I remember that about nursing school and the racist professors that I had. You know, one of my white friends, I sang at her wedding. And, you know, they really frowned on nurses getting married in nursing school. Oh, no. She got married. Ay, ay, ay. They wrote her like, I don't want to know what. And then she got pregnant. And you, back then, we had to have 94 to get an A. 88, was it 88, 87, 80, something like that to get a B. Anyway, 75 was flunking. And they flunked her out of school in 75. Yep. The last semester in college. I'll never forget it. It was just horrible, Carolyn. You know, she was, but then she married an Iranian guy, so. And we had two that were married in the class before me. I had forgotten about that. And so they told them they couldn't walk at graduation because both of them were pregnant. And so the class said, if they don't walk, we're not walking. We don't have no graduation. Mm-hmm. So not only did they walk, they put them right at the front as two that first marched. I think about that. In fact, in England, nurses weren't allowed to marry until the 1940s. I'm watching this program called London Hospital, how they treated the sick in 1900, and I'm looking at this like, whoa, I can't believe it. Yeah, but nurses were not allowed to get married. You got married, you lost your job. Not until the 40s. Yeah, so most of the nurses that I work with on the ward, professional nurses, they were single when I was in school. You know, it was looked down upon to marry. You were supposed to be married to nursing. Yeah, and they all smoked. That was another thing. I didn't pick up that habit. But smoking was the big thing then, and everybody on my rotation smoked. They loved to get me in the middle in that station wagon, and they'd roll up the windows and they'd say, let's all light up. And I said, oh God, I'm going to die. So then I tried to do it. The smoke was kind of in my ears. I said, this is not for me. So, yeah, but I think, but I'd do it all over again. I would do it all over again to get the kind of education that I got, you know. Yeah, to get, because I work with some nurses in South Africa. One had only been a nurse for 4 years, and I'm looking at them like, no. They don't know what they're talking about. And then she's a lactation nurse. How are you going to do home visits on all these older people that have chronic diseases and you just work with mothers and breastfeeding? That's not their issue down here. No. So, anyway, she says, Kamisa, if you come back, I'll come back with you. And I said to myself, no. I don't think so. If I come back by myself. Next.
Were there any kind of tensions or rivalries between folks at your school?
Well, in junior high school, you know, there was always that crowd. There's always been that crowd of the, what do they call it? I guess you would call them rowdy now. But those was the tough girls, you know. As you got in their way. And those are the ones that would have the fights after school, that pulling each other's clothes off. And at those times, we wore those sanitary belts. And you could just see it under clothes and everything flying. And I'd be running home from school. So you didn't really even have to say anything to agitate them. They would just look at you and just say, we don't like you. And so after school, you know, they were going to chase you home or beat you up. I know, but you just always had those kind of girls that they wore the makeup. Even then, you know, they would be the one to wear the weave now, but they had. I shouldn't say all people that wear weaves are not like that, but much. And then in high school, it was more like it was the good girls against the ones that were going out with boys, smoking, and cutting school. We had truant officers back then, you know. So you can be walking the street doing school hours, a truant officer would pick you up, and you'd go juvenile. So you had to go to school. And I never cut school. I was always afraid. I said, oh, my daddy will kill me. Somebody picks me up. And they said, you went all the way through school and never cut? I said, mm-mm. When my dad said he was going to do it, I believed him. No, and I was not going to shame my father or bring any disgrace. They were smoking behind the gym. You know, they were doing heroin and all that kind of stuff. A big deal then was smoking a cigarette. Not marijuana, but just sneaking and smoking a cigarette. I said, no. So it was kind of the good girls against the bad girls, and I guess I was considered, what would you want to say? I don't want to use the word egghead or... Well, she thinks she's all that because she wants to go to college, because they didn't have no desire to go to college. You know, some of them didn't. And then they tracked us then. You know, they had slower kids, which was horrible. They had portables. And even in junior high and high school, I remember that, the slower kids went to the portables. So if you were in the portables, the whole school knew that you were a little slow, you know. Not retarded, but just didn't seem to grasp the information. And I had the opportunity to see one of these girls, and I knew we had a couple classes together, but most of her classes were in the portables. And I saw her maybe 10, 15 years ago, and she's become a nurse. And she had to tell me. She said, yeah, I remember you used to hang around with Carolyn and all those girls that was going to UC Berkeley. And I said, oh, really? Oh, okay. So that's kind of how we kind of divided up. They were very, very hard on anybody that got pregnant. Anybody. You was just like a slut, and parents did not want you to hang around those girls. You know, now Gwen was a different story. I think probably Carolyn's father didn't want to, but my father didn't say anything. He worked with Gwen's father at General Motors. But her mama was a Church of God in Christ, and you will get married, you know. So she made her get married to a 16. But, yeah, it was, you were kicked to the corner. You got pregnant, you were kicked to the corner, and girls were not to talk to you, and they was, you know, the cold shoulder. So, yeah. It was worse than that when my... my father was coming along. My dad was born in 1914. His brother was born in 1916. Well, he got a young lady pregnant. And he was a boy. It was okay. But back then in the country, they made you come before the church and ask for forgiveness. So she had to do that. And she said at that time she became a slave at 17. Her father was a small country Methodist preacher. He would shame the family, and no girls were allowed to talk with her. My uncle just was footloose and fancy free. but my grandmother stepped in, and she said, oh, and you know, because then, if you weren't married, the child had to take your last name. And a lot of places is that way right now. My grandmother went straight over there to that midwife, and she said, this is Dennis's child, and this is how we spell our last name. And she supported and helped her, but she said she was so afraid. So I got to talk with her at length, and she said we had sex one time, and she got pregnant. She was 17. She said a man never touched me again until I was 34 years old. Her mother died, I think, when she was 19. So she said, I became a slave. I had to raise all those kids. I couldn't go to school. You know, I brought shame to the family. So it was bad. No, my aunt got pregnant too. Let me see. My daddy's born in 14 and Mary's born in 18, and she got married. She got pregnant at 15. And my grandfather got the, what do you call that rifle? Winchester. They used to have it across the door in the country. They built a thing right across the door so they could grab it. And he pointed the gun at the young man, oh, you will marry my daughter. So that's what they mean by shotgun wedding. That is a shotgun wedding. So she had to get married too. You know, it was one of my father's friends, and the marriage didn't last. But then even at that, she was grown. She was 20 years old. Then he makes my, when she came back home, he makes my dad put her in the Model T Ford, drive her 30 miles away to her sister's house and tell his sister, that she is not to leave that house. Now, she's a grown woman with a 4-year-old, that she's not to leave that house and better be not in the company of any man. But just how the control parents had over you back then. It's amazing. Says she's not to leave that house unless her brother, who was my father, comes back to pick her up. Yeah, so I'm telling you, women have been through some stuff. They have been through some stuff. Yeah, but I used to feel sorry for the girls. I remember Brenda Barrow. Her was a prominent family in town. They owned a cleaners. And we were 10th grade. And Ira was in the senior. He was a big basketball star. She got pregnant. It was awful. It's like her whole life did a flip-flop. You know, just shunned. And they did that, you know. Christian people. Yeah. So they forgot what Paul said. He said you're supposed to reprimand them. And not kick them to the curb, but just leave them out there for a while. But they always forget the part about, then you bring them back in. Love them. That part, they don't go further enough down the scripture to read that part. Mm-hmm. So Christian people can be really, really mean to folks. Yeah, she said she had to, they called it begging the pardon when you go before the church to ask for forgiveness. Yeah. So, yeah, I've experienced that with some friends of mine. But the biggest tension was between this is a good girl and this is a bad girl, or this is a rough girl and this is someone going somewhere. And some of the girls were just rough. They just like to pick a fight over nothing just to show that they could beat somebody up, you know. So I just avoided them. You know, it's like you're on one side of the track, the other. Okay, we sit on this bench. It was funny then because in high school, people had, and I don't know if they do that now, people had certain benches that they sit on. Was this their core group or whatever? So this is where you meet at lunchtime. Duck from the pigeons that were dropping poop on your head. But we always sit on certain benches, and someone would be out there in the field kissing boys and stuff. And so, of course, the young ladies that were going to college was just think that was disgusting, you know. But wow. Yeah, I said, Lord, if they could see what they're doing now. And my granddaughter comes home, and I said, you're 12 years old and you shaved your legs? What do you know about shaving legs? And my daughter's shocked with some of those little white girls and told her, because she goes to Oakland Middle, and I don't think they've got some black students there, but not enough. And I said, shaving your legs? They're wearing lipstick, all this stuff. But my granddaughter doesn't. I said, no. They all got phones. They have phones in the 5th grade now. Who are you calling? Grandma, you have to have a phone because it's an emergency. I said, what did we do in the old days? Go to the office. They have a phone in the office. Okay. Nope, everybody had a phone. I said, why would you want a phone in your backpack and it's off? Well, if it buzzes, then I know it's my mama. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah, she got them both a phone in 5th, 6th grade. So I leave it alone because I'm old fogey. So but anyway, and that's how come nobody talks now, because they're all going to the airport. Anywhere you go, people got their head down. I said, they're all going to have arthritis in their neck and carpal tunnel in their finger. Somebody will be working. The orthopedic people will be working. Okay. Child, we may have to make this in 2 parts. I see why this lady took 4 hours. I didn't think it was going to be like this. A million questions.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Were there any kind of tensions or rivalries between folks from your school and from other schools?
Oh, yes. Yes. Very competitive, especially with basketball and football. I mean, there seems to be rivalries here, but it's like, oh, you know, it's just team spirit. But back then, people would fight. I told you, I went to a school called Casamont, and our mascot was the knight. And then we went to which our school was half white, half black, and then we went to McClyman's, which was all black, and the school my uncles had gone to. And my uncle was the one that designed that Indian for their yearbook, and their mascot was the Indian. And they would tell you straight up, if we don't win the game, we're going to win the fight. And that's when you have to run home. God, just, seventh inning or whenever. I'm leaving early to get on the bus. And people would just hang around because they wanted to fight. And we had something called a TOC, which was a Tournament of Champions. And then all the teams from all the, I think we had six high schools in my town, would come together. And they didn't seem to fight too much there. But those football games, yes, there's always a fight. Always a fight. So you always have the police there and stuff, but kids gonna find a way to fight. But it wasn't with guns or knives or anything like that. They was fist fights. They was gonna, you know, rip your clothes off, slap you around, all that kind of crazy stuff. I know that's happened to my cousin. I guess he must have had to run home with just his shorts from high school. But, you know, he was a boy. Shouldn't have been hanging around there. You know, those kids are crazy when they don't win the game. So, And my dad didn't even know I was going to those games. He would have had a heart attack. I just say, oh, there's a football game. He's thinking that it's at my school when it's actually across town. And we were riding the bus over there. But I had sense enough to know, no, I'm getting home. Because if there's any kind of mess and he has to come to the juvenile or police to pick me up, no, he's not going to hit me, but looks could kill, I'd be dead. Yeah, so, no, that fear of my father kept me out of trouble, you know. But, I mean, I just didn't really have any desire to do nothing crazy. But I guess because I never trusted kids, you know. I was always, you know, I couldn't be coerced into doing it because other people were doing it because I didn't trust them. That's why they, looking on somebody else's page, no, they might be stupider than me. Why am I going to cheat off of their page? And I worked hard and you ain't looking at my page. No. So that's the way that goes. Oh, can you see? Let me see your, did you do your homework last night? You didn't do it? No. Turn back around. No, indeed. No. So that was the major contention, I think, was football games. Yeah. And then they had their little gangs, some of the boys, you know, if you lived, what's one of them called? The Ramp Rats. And there was another one. But it was just boys that wore the same jacket, and it was like a hoodish kind of club. But, you know, they didn't do nothing crazy. Nothing crazy, not like these kids do now. Like they have to kill somebody now to say they're part of the gang. No, none of that stuff. No.
What was the school you said where they said if they didn't win the game, they
would... McClyman's.
McClyman's.
Yeah. When I went to Castlemont, I was a knight. Yeah, Kermit used to be our, what do you call it, mascot. Yeah, I was always proud to be a knight. One of our original buildings was like the castle. It probably was built in 1920. Now that school is, that whole area, the white people have moved further and further, so that whole area is black now and run down. And it's just, what do you call that, white flight in the region? It's just awful. And people don't have no jobs, and so just things go downhill. It's in every city.
Any rivalries in sports or other arenas?
Well, that's part of the same question, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just the football. Rivalries. Well, and just those hoodish girls. You know, because I think a lot of it was just, I don't want to say jealousy, but just that no one cared enough about them to say that they were also worthy. It was like nobody cared, so they're going to act out, you know, because it wasn't like they had parents who cared, and the teachers looked at them and said, well, you're making C's and D's, we're not going to waste no time on you. So it was like nobody cared, because some of them were not... they weren't dumb or stupid, because one of the girls that I met later, years and years later, at church, she and I had gone to school together. And she was one of the ones, you know, she got it for best figure, because that was a big thing, you know, dressing. And the boys back then, you know, they wore suits to hide, I mean, what do you call it, blazers and tie and carry a little briefcase, because that was a big deal back then. And she didn't go to college. She might have gone to one semester or something. She got a job in the bank at Wells Fargo, and she worked her way up. She's vice president. But she says, "Come here, I remember you. You sit with Carolyn, you, the smart kids over there on that bench." No. But she was, you know, all the boys, because she had a figure like with an hourglass. And so she was attracting the attention of all the boys. So school wasn't her focus, but it was being the beauty queen. You know, that was the thing. But she's vice president of the bank now. We've become really good friends. Yeah. I met her, let's see, we graduated from high school in 66, and I met her again in about 1992 at church. And her ex-husband would say, "I saw that goofy-looking picture of you in the yearbook." Yeah, so she kept her yearbook. I can't find mine. It's probably in one of those boxes in the garage. But, yeah, so.
What were your favorite subjects, and what made them your favorites?
I loved history. I loved music, because I loved to sing. I know I had a pretty nice voice when I was growing up, but I was so shy of getting in front of people. But I knew every song that the choir sang, every word. I would sit in the audience and sing. And my mother used to tell me all the time, she said, "You know, if you have a gift and you don't use it, the Lord will take it." I mean, I was a first soprano. I could break a glass. Now I'm like a second soprano, almost an alto. But I, she died when I was 13, and so my cousin, when I was 14, she said to me, "You see my wedding? It's your wedding." Oh! I was so scared. And so the lady that I was practicing with, she said, "Now, Kamisi, just look at the tops of their head. They think that you're looking at their face. Look at the top of their heads." So I sang the Lord's Prayer, and "Because," it's a song they sing at weddings. And then from there, I sang at weddings, my classmates in nursing school. And then the ultimate honor, they asked me to sing the Lord's Prayer at my graduation from nursing school. And it was a big Presbyterian church. It has a pipe organ. I love a pipe organ. They have a pipe organ in Nashville at the symphony. And the guy said, because I didn't read music, he said, "Well, what key are you singing?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, just play something." Because I have a good ear for music. And he said, "Well, that's the key of C." So I sang with this renowned organist at the First Presbyterian Church on 27th and Broadway. It's almost a whole city block large. It's a huge church. It's like you're walking into a cathedral. It has these wonderful acoustics. And I sang there. And then when my little sisters graduated, well, 2 or 3 years later, I had a baby by then, and they asked me to come and sing. So I always loved music. But history, I'm just fascinated. It's like I traveled around the world in books, because I look at all these pictures. My mother, like I said, she was domestic, so, you know, they give you their stuff. We couldn't afford an encyclopedia. They're obsolete now because of the internet. Back then, I would read encyclopedias like books, and I would say, "I want to go here and go here." And so I think about that. The first time I took the kids to Yosemite, I drove into the park, and I saw El Capitan and Glacier, Half Dome. And I said, I remember in fifth grade seeing all these places. And I was so excited, and a blue fox just walked right in front of our car. And I got so excited, I made the wrong turn, and we drove out the park again, had to drive back again. But I said, you know, I've dreamed of this place since I was in the fifth grade, and I took the kids, and I said, I'm going to cover this whole park, unless we may not be able to get here again. So I stayed a week. I went places most people don't go. I took them up 10,000 feet to Tuolumne Meadows, where there were no people. No, I wouldn't do nothing crazy like that now, because anybody could have killed us up there. A bear attacked us. But... I wasn't thinking. You can hear yourself breathe. It's so quiet. But just in history, and I think it started with Mrs. Bass doing that report on the United Nations. I had to do research on every country that was a part of the United Nations. And And I think about that now. I sit and I say, God has blessed me that I have been to the Grand Canyon, that I've not only seen Victoria Falls, I got in a helicopter and flew over it. That I've been to South Africa, that I've been to Paris, that I've been to England, and I've been to Italy, that God has afforded me all these things. And I still got a lot of my bucket list that I'm working on. You know, places I want to go. I've been to Ghana. I haven't been to Egypt yet. I want to see, well, I did want to see the Great Wall of China, but when those kids cheated the other year in the Olympics, that pretending that they were teenagers and they were 10 years old on the gymnastics, I said, I don't know if I want to see that. I just have to see it on TV, because that's the only thing that the astronauts can see is the Great Wall of China when they look back besides the oceans. That's the only thing that they can see that's actually built on the Earth. So I want to go to Alaska, I think, and I'd always loved whales because my kids said, Mom, our friends think you're nuts. They say, what did you do on the weekend? We say, my mom took us whale watching. And they all love history. All of them. They all love history. And the knucklehead that I was married to, you know, they had to watch PBS McNair Lehrer Report. So they can go toe-to-toe with you on anything that's politics. You know, he was a political science major at Stanford. But they all love history. And I think that's what drew me to him, because he traveled around Europe with $200 in a sock, sleeping on park benches. He went to Haiti. He was able to go into areas where they allowed him to see voodoo practices and things going on. So we would just talk for hours. I was just mesmerized by that. But all of my kids love history, all of them. And history was my favorite, you know. It's like, the world is so small. I went all the way to Ghana with the pastor to do a water project. And we're sitting in a pizza parlor, and this guy comes in with dreads, and we start talking. And I can tell he's American. And he said, where are you from? He was a brother. And I said, oh, I'm from California. He said, where in California? I said, Vallejo. He said, Vallejo? He said, I was there last week speaking to church. Now you go halfway around the world, 10,000 miles, and meet somebody that was just in your town the week before. So it really is a small world. And I just wish more of our people could travel. There's so much to see. So much to see that God has created such an incredible earth. So I'm still working my 7 wonders of the world. But I've got 3 of them down. So, I mean, have you been to the Grand Canyon?
No.
You just stand there. You don't know what to say. You can't even, people say, how was it? You can't put it into words. But a little river carved all of that. And then to see the falls, and Autra and I went in October. They were full, but not as full as they get in May. And when my daughter was there, she said, I was 2 miles away, and we had to have an umbrella and a coat. The mist was like a drenching rain 2 miles away. This is amazing. It's amazing. To be on a safari and think, oh, this is like National Geographic. These zebras over there, the wildebeest just nearby, and the lion, and I saw a cheetah, and it's like, I don't believe this. I rode the back of an elephant. So, it's just, and then with the whole thing with the presidency, with history, you know, I worked for decent people then back in California.
Thank you, Barnes & Noble customers. The time is now 8:45, and the French Barnes & Noble Books, Music, and Cafe will close in 15 minutes at 9 p.m.
Okay.
At this time, we ask that you begin making your final selections for purchase and bring them to the cash registers at the front of the store or the music department.
Yeah.
Once again, it's 8:45, and we close in 15 minutes. Thank you for shopping with us, and have a great time.
Yeah. And I just thought, I said, you know, this is history. I've got to go to that, we've got to go to Denver to see him nominated. So I called my girlfriend and I said, Autra, we need to see if we can get a flight to Denver. She said, for what? I said, this is history. This is a black man being inducted. We have got to go. So I went to my manager and I said, you know, I need to get off. And she said, oh, okay, just get someone to see your patients. And so we went. We didn't even know how we were going to get in there. And she had her sister, had a niece that lived in Denver, so we could come bunk with her. And we went to the airport, rented a car, dropped our stuff off with her, and then we drove to downtown Denver. And so she said, okay, can we see how we're supposed to get in there now? I said, just follow these white kids. I started asking them, now how can you get in there and volunteer? And they said, you go over here, sit in that class for 2 hours, get that shirt, She said, well, what if we're outside handing out leaflets? I said, no, we're getting in. Sure did. Got in. Was usher at the door. Who came through my door? Anderson Cooper. Who was the other big guy on 60 Minutes? Dan Rather. Marvin Winans. All these people. And so then I got the telephone. I had a phone then. And I said, I've never had an American flag in my hand. Never thought I'd wave one. And I called the girls and I said, you see? Waving this flag. And they said, Mom, you are crazy. This is history. And I went to the inauguration too. Stood out there in that 19 degree weather with my feet frozen. I didn't think I was going to make it, but I made it. Yeah. So anything with history, I love. You know, except this Trump stuff. Nobody should even write that down. Well, this is nonsense. It's just stupidity. But that's, I guess it's good in a way because so many people in this country think like that. Yeah. So yeah, even this thing about the Confederate flag. I was going to church on Sunday and I said, what's holding the traffic up? We were just going down Rutherford. And I look up and everybody's looking at this guy because he's got this big truck and he's got like three huge Confederate flags and he's just, they're blowing in the wind as he's right down the street. And I'm saying, everybody's stuck in 1864. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to know, you know, about my ancestors, where my people came from, all the stuff, and I used to bug the heck out of my dad. Well, I don't know where he came from. Somewhere in South Carolina. I said, but where? And he would get so mad at me, you know. So I said, I'm going to find out. And sure enough, I sure did. And they have an incredible, incredible history. I'm so proud of their history because with no education, what are you traveling by, the North Star? I mean, it's not like you got GPS or a map, and you're going 795 miles from Newberry, South Carolina to Arkansas, and take you 4 months in a wagon with nine of you. Now, 4 months, you got to stop and eat. You got to shoot something, light a fire, and in those times, those paddy rollers were coming through, pulling people back into servitude, you know, into chattel slavery. So when my dad used to say, I don't know, Papa used to say, but they said they had to steal away. So even though they were free, this is 1 side of the family went in 1879, but I think Henry was like in the 1880s. But they just couldn't walk off, even though they were sharecropping. They had to steal away. So I know they laugh at me, he's thinking he's just chasing them dead people, but history. And I said, we don't light a candle to them. I'd like to see you go someplace 4 months in a wagon and then get there and there's a forest and you have to cut the trees down. Build your own churches. They built four Lutheran churches there. Their own schools. And do you know about the Rosenwald schools? You should look that up. Mm-hmm. Rosenwald was one of the founders of Sears and Roebuck. And back in the 30s and 40s, he built hundreds of schools all over, mostly the Southeast and the Midwest. And I have two Rosenwald schools in my family, one in Arkansas, one in Newberry. Yeah. So just read the history of those. It's enough to blow you away. When I went to Newberry, these people that have it now have turned into a barn. So I had to tell my cousin, okay, this is private property. Drive up into the driveway, keep the motor running. I jump out, take a picture. And this lady comes out. What are you doing? Well, that used to be my family school. She's not going to understand that. But anyway, so then we drove off. She said, Kimmy, you're going to get us killed.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, wow. So there's such a rich history. And, you know, our silly ancestors wrote everything down, so you know, you can find a lot of the information. I mean, I found my great-grandfather on two wills. Mm-hmm. One, what was the first one? 1861. And the other one was 1866, and I can never figure that one out, because I'm saying, Henry, were you slow? The war was over in 1865. But when you look at a picture of him, he looked like Wyatt Earp, so obviously he thought he was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know he had to have some money. That's him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, see that German.
Where did you get this picture from?
Let me see. Where did I get it from? My Aunt Annie, who's my grandfather's sister, she was only 5 years old when he died, so she must have got it from her mom. Now, this is her mom. That's Rebecca, let's see. So she was Cherokee and white and African, and he was German and African. Yeah, because his last name was Litzy. She's a Scott. Jake, well, actually, a Lee. Her parents were Jake Lee and Dora Scott. And his, my cousin thinks he found the slave girl, but we know who the father was. He was like a fourth generation from the Rhineland in Germany. But the only way I was able to do this is because once I got to 1860, that my white cousins had done the white genealogy. So they made it real easy for me. Once I found him on the will. On the first page of the will, it says, I will my man Henry. And he willed him to his brother. Yeah. Yeah, he was born 1827. Yeah, and so he was 53 years old. Now, you gonna get in a wagon at 53? And his first wife had died, and then she was like 20, but she already had a baby 7 months old, and Uncle George was 3. So I've just had that inquisitiveness in my mind, like, where do we come from? How do we get over here from Africa? just always wanted to know that, and it's unfortunate that all through our secondary school, we didn't get a whole lot of practically none on African American history. Did you, growing up?
And you went in New York? Carolina. No, I was born and raised in Charleston.
In Charleston, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we got some.
But what about the Gullah people? You didn't get information about the Gullahs?
So, it's interesting. Kind of, and I'm actually doing a project on this now because my honors research is focused on the incorporation of the Geechee language into the classroom.
Oh,
and what that means for building a positive classroom culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the language in Charleston, so you know, like, the Gullah language is recognized as a Creole language, and it's the only language outside of the dialect that's in New York New Orleans is recognized as a separate language.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not primarily used. It's very on the islands. It'll be used a lot. Like my father's family is based out of Wadmalaw. And that you'll hear it a lot more deeply then, but what we speak.
What about
now,
Sepala Island and those? Because I want to go back there. Oh, because you
heard of Sepala Island.
There's so many islands.
There's a lot of islands.
Long. Yeah, but see, there you have to get there by boat and there's no cars on it.
Yeah.
And now that people are going back there building these resorts,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
the people are having to move because of the taxes and all this nonsense.
Yeah.
But I went on a tour, let's see, that was 7 years ago. And the guy was. That's another thing my dad used to say. I said, well, I don't know. They were rice-eating people. They were
mm-hmm,
Geechees.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what's a Geechee?
Yeah. Yeah.
He always said that about Papa, that he was Geechee.
Yeah, we still call ourselves that now.
Yeah, Geechee. And see, and I know I'm home because they eat collard greens. I moved here. Oh. People are mustard green crazy.
Yep.
Yeah. And they eat collard greens in South Carolina. But I would love to see your research. I have, and but I'm. They've got World Scholar has tours there. They've got a 1 week tour where I can go to 3 of the islands, and you hear lectures. And there's a black lady there on Sepala Island that I think there's like only 200 or 300 people still living there on the island. Yeah, I mean, they just run everybody off, where the people come to the mainland, and then they don't go back. Yeah, but I bought a lot of paintings. I went to Charleston in November, and I went crazy. There's this well-renowned artist there. He does these big pictures of the women with the big brass hats. And those pictures that I paid $30 for 6 years ago, I got $5. I think I brought about 50 of them. I've given a couple of them away. My daughter said, Mom, what are you going to do with all those pictures? All over the walls. I forget his name, but but he's a well-renowned artist from Charleston.
Yeah.
But I love Charleston. I love the market. I bartered hard for that mm-hmm. basket.
Mm-hmm. It's great. Yeah. A lot of people. My grandmother can. She says she can't make them, but she can. Her sisters make them. And then I have cousins who make them, and they primarily make their living off of them. It's so funny because my uncle, the mother of his children, I'll go to their house and all they do is make baskets, and so I'll come in and that's what, like, they'll make baskets and they'll sell them like on the side of the road, but they're like Mount Pleasant, which is the part where my family is primarily based out of. They need permits now to sell them on the side of the roads, and so they're pushing out a lot of the black people who are selling baskets and
but you have to go in that market downtown. You're going to have to give them a cut.
Well, here's the thing about the market is that a lot of that space is like has been willed to people down from generations. Mm-hmm. So it's there are slots that you, like, if you get there first you get it, but there are other slots that are just like designated for particular people. So mm-hmm. it's hard to get a spot at the market to begin with. But they're also Mount Pleasant, which is, and they're in a deeper part of Mount Pleasant, which is going towards Onondaga, and that's like,
yeah, I went through Mount, because we stayed in a place down there on the beach, but I went through Mount Pleasant. They got a Tuesday, what do you call that? Tuesday morning, or it's a store like TJ Maxx, where we went in Mount Pleasant.
Was it near a grocery store?
Yeah, near a grocery store.
That's the old village. That's literally where my family lives.
Right. Because I know, because mm-hmm. we ate there at a restaurant, too. So yeah. I've been there twice. And then there's a lady that came from New York that started at a restaurant there. She used to be a chef in New York. I've gone to her restaurant 3 times. Ooh. And I got her cookbook.
There's Gullah Cuisine. A lot right. of people go there. Yeah.
And she was there that day, so I bought her cookbook.
It's closing. Gullah Cuisine is closing. I don't know. I can't even remember. I saw an article about that. They have really good soup. They catered my parents, was it their engagement ceremony? And that man, my father's 60th birthday party. I mean, my grandfather's 60th birthday party.
Why are they closing?
I really can't. That was the first place I had fried alligators. Was Bella's.
Well, my daughter said that what did she call it? The shrimp and grits was better than six.
But
she
said
I'm allergic to shrimp. So that I can't is eat that.
But there's another place, Alouette. I don't know if you've heard of them. It's
in the same area?
No, it's downtown. In downtown Charleston. And they have, it's organic soul food.
I went someplace down there.